So you're in your squad car and you get a 911 call, and there's a woman who makes a report, calls 911 and says, "My neighbor is acting erratically and hacking at a tree with a knife." And what are you thinking? What are you thinking at that point when you get that call? Is this a dangerous situation? And what is it about the situation that makes it dangerous? And it's the dealing with someone who's mentally unstable. If you have a 911 call where a neighbor's hacking at a tree with a hatchet, you're not going to think a whole lot about that. But the fact that someone is hacking at a tree with a knife and that they seem to be erratic and behaving in a way that is unstable, that kind of creates a dangerous situation. At least you're kind of thinking going in, this is going to be a dangerous situation. And because we run into situations that are dangerous when we're dealing with people who are mentally unstable, and mostly because you just can't reason with a person who's irrational. So that's kind of where we're at going in, and that's what we're going to be talking about today. We got a case, and it's a Supreme Court decision. It just came out a few days ago, and it's an interesting case. And I'm going to call it the case of the neighbor with a knife.
Bringing you the latest case law updates on the legal aspects of law enforcement. This is Broadcast Blue.
So welcome to Bruce's Brown Bag Wednesday webinar on this fourth day of April of 2018. And we're going to look at this Supreme Court decision today. And the name of the case is Casella versus Hughes. This comes to us again from the United States Supreme Court in our 10th edition of Bruce's Brown Bag Wednesday webinar for 2018. Let me talk about the key phrases in the Blue Key cases, cases that you ought to be very familiar with. We're going to look at the key phrases today are use of force, deadly force, qualified immunity, what it takes to be clearly established principles for the purposes of a two-prong test for qualified immunity. And our Blue Key cases, Tennessee versus Garner, Graham versus Connor, White v. Pauley, Mullinix v. Luna, and Plumhoff v. Ricard. So here we go. Let's get these facts a little bit more down for the decision here. More than what I gave you in the intro anyway. So you get a person, there's a neighbor, a female, she calls 911, and this case comes to us from Tucson, Arizona. And the facts occurred around the May of 2010, sometime in May of 2010. So it's been a while. It's taken 8 years to work its way up to the Supreme Court on this this civil suit. So back in May of 2010, a woman in Hughes's neighborhood called 911 to report that a woman was hacking at a tree with a kitchen knife and behaving erratically. Officer Casella, along with another trainee police officer, his name is Alex Garcia, heard about the report. They hear this on the radio in their patrol car, and they respond to the call. And when they arrive in the area, the person who actually had made the 911 call flagged them down. So now this person not only makes a 911 call, but goes out and flags down the officers, gives them a very good description of the woman who had the knife and told them that she had been acting erratically. A third officer, Lindsay Coons, then arrives on the scene on her bicycle. So Officer Garcia, who is in the car with Officer Casella, spots a woman that they later identified as Sharon Chadwick, and she's standing next to a car in a driveway of a house that's close to them behind a chain link fence that has a locked gate. So there's a fence in front of this house apparently with a lock on it. And so there's a locked gate and she's behind a chain link fence standing next to the car in the driveway. And so at that point, the three officers see another woman matching the description that the 911 caller had given them. She's coming out of the house carrying a large knife at her side, a large kitchen knife. And it's Hughes, who was the plaintiff in this 1983 lawsuit. So Hughes walks towards Chadwick. She comes out of the house. She closes the distance. She's standing no more than 6 feet from Hughes with the knife in her hand. All three of the officers draw their guns at least twice. They tell Hughes to drop the knife. There's some disputes about what was actually said after that by Chadwick, but viewing the record in light most favorable to Hughes, which is what happens on a motion for summary judgment, Chadwick said, "Take it easy," to Hughes and to the officers. Hughes appears calm, but she does not acknowledge the officer's presence. And more importantly, she does not drop the knife on any of the times that she's commanded to drop the knife. Officer Casella drops to the ground and takes aim and shoots Hughes 4 times through a gap in the chain link fence. And then the officers jump the fence. They handcuff Hughes and they call in the paramedics. They take Hughes to the hospital where she's treated and released. She was shot 4 times, but none of the injuries were life threatening. So, and the court noted that less than a minute had transpired from the moment that the officers first saw Chadwick standing next to the car to the moment that Casella fired the shot. So that's all of this happened in far less time than it took me to tell you about it. It took place in a very quick, just a matter of a minute there. Okay, so those are the important facts. Now, the court included a bunch of other facts in the decision at this point, including things that were known to Chadwick at the time, but were not known to the officers at the time. And to the extent that we're going to talk about Graham versus Connor and 20/20 hindsight and the facts that the reasonable officers presented with at the time, given the fact that none of the officers were aware of any of the facts that were that the court talks about with respect facts that were known to Chadwick, they're not relevant. And they weren't relevant to the opinion. I'm not quite so sure why it was even included. Another quick little thing to point out in this case, it's just really kind of interesting. It's a per curiam decision, which means there is no named author. It comes from the court and not from a specific justice. Typically, per curiam decisions are unanimous and there's not a dissent, but every once in a while you get a dissenting opinion to a per curiam decision. And there is a dissent in this case, and a rather scary one that I'll talk about. So let's see what happens. We got this 1983 lawsuit. It's under Title 42, Section 1983. It's been filed, a cause of action there for excessive use of force. Hughes is claiming that the officer should not have shot her, that the use of force by Officer Casella in shooting her 4 times was unreasonable and excessive under the Fourth Amendment, and she's entitled to relief in a 1983 action. Now, the district court granted summary judgment to Officer Casella. Officer Casella, through his attorney, files a motion for summary judgment for qualified immunity, concept of qualified immunity. And the district court granted summary judgment to Officer Casella. And then it goes up to the Ninth Circuit, and the Ninth Circuit reversed the district court. And the Ninth Circuit held that there was both a violation of the Fourth Amendment and that the violation was clearly established by law when it occurred. And therefore, Officer Casella is not entitled to qualified immunity. And it goes up to the Supreme Court, and that's where it's going to be headed. Now, they asked there was a petition. Officer Casella, through his attorney, petitioned for a rehearing in bank. And over the dissent of 7 of the judges in the Ninth Circuit, that petition for rehearing was denied. And then the writ of cert to the Supreme Court was granted, and that's where we're at. So we've got the Supreme Court looking at this decision. And the sole issue is whether the Ninth Circuit erred in reversing the district court's grant of the summary judgment to Officer Casella. Did the Ninth Circuit make the right call? And that's what the case is going to look at. So we have a few, obviously, some legal blasts from the past that are important, and they are all very significant, a significant part of the majority decision here. So it's always good to have a quick little refresher on these. And Tennessee versus Garner, that very famous case that changed the law in, I think, 36 states as a result of this decision, where the officer has probable cause to believe that the suspect poses a threat of serious physical harm either to the officer or to others, which is very on point in this case, it is not constitutionally unreasonable to prevent escape by using deadly force. And then we have the gold standard for use of force. Graham versus Connor talked about this one a lot last week at the ILETA conference, a very, very good conference in St. Louis. The reasonableness of a particular use of force must be judged from the perspective of a reasonable officer on the scene rather than with 20/20 vision of hindsight. The concept, the reasonable officer standard, and without 20/20 hindsight, without, in other words, with the facts that they are presented with at the point in time that the decision that force is used is made. And remember, this is kind of a, the court understands this is somewhat of a vague and a standard that's going to be based very, very much on the facts. Each case is going to be very much determined on its facts. And it's a very significant thing. And so they gave us our four factors. I didn't put the four Graham factors up, but remember, you've got the severity of the crime, the immediacy of the threat, and whether or not there is active resistance or whether or not the person is attempting to flee. Those are your four Graham factors to help you determine the reasonableness without that 20/20 hindsight. And then another very, very important part of the Graham decision, which a lot of times doesn't get mentioned, and it really should, and it's the calculus portion of that decision, which is incredibly significant. The calculus of reasonableness must embody allowance for the fact that police officers are often forced to make split-second judgments in circumstances that are tense, uncertain, and rapidly evolving about the amount of force necessary in a particular situation. So there you go. That's the calculus concept, which is important as well. And then we have a White versus Polly, a decision that came out just last year. Qualified immunity attaches when an official's conduct does not violate clearly established statutory or constitutional rights of which a reasonable person would have known. So it has to be clearly established. There has to be a violation, and the violation has to be clearly established at the time. What does it mean to be clearly established? Although the court's case law does not require a case directly on point for a right to be clearly established, existing precedent must have placed the statutory or constitutional question beyond debate. I add the emphasis there. Beyond debate. What does it mean to be clearly established? It's beyond debate. And then another very important part of this. In other words, immunity protects all but the plainly incompetent or those who knowingly violate the law. And that those are pretty strong words. The qualified immunity is going to protect all but the plainly incompetent. And that's pretty powerful language from the Supreme Court. And then from the Mullinex v. Luna case, a very significant decision that came out a few years ago that deals with the specificity. It has to be it has to be clearly defined. The conduct, to be beyond debate, it has to be specific and not general. You can't just make a general thing, well, it's unconstitutional, so it's a beyond debate, but it's unreasonable. You can't use general terms like that. Specificity is especially important in the Fourth Amendment context, where the court has recognized that it's sometimes difficult for an officer to determine how relevant legal doctrine, excessive force, will apply to the factual situation the officer confronts. That's, you know, every case is different and on its facts, and it has to be so clear that it's beyond debate that a reasonable officer would have known that the actions would constitute excessive use of force. That's pretty much the standard, and that's what we're looking for. So it's important if you want to see what the Supreme Court did. First, the court noted that it did not need to and does not. It's the quote, let me quote them straight from their decision. It says, here the court need not and does not decide whether Casella violated the Fourth Amendment when he used deadly force against Hughes. And so what they're doing is what the courts have been doing to get the two prongs to qualified immunity, right? You have to show that there was a constitutional right that was violated, and you have to show that that right was clearly established at the time. That's what's required in order for the officer not to get qualified immunity. The plaintiff's got to show that there was a violation that was clearly established and at the time. So the two prongs. The court doesn't have to answer those in any particular order. And so in this decision, as in others, the court is going to, the court says, for even assuming a Fourth Amendment violation occurred, a proposition that is not at all evident, on these facts, Casella was at least entitled to qualified immunity. And what they're saying is that it's not clearly established. Even if you're going to argue, even if for argument's sake, you say that there was a Fourth Amendment violation, that it was not clearly established at the time. And so therefore, Casella would be entitled to qualified immunity. They're skipping over the first question and saying that it's not clearly established. And so their focus, even though they spent a lot of time talking about facts, their focus is going to be based on that second part. Was it clearly established? In quoting the Plumhoff v. Rickard case, the court said, an officer cannot be said to have violated a clearly established right unless the right's contours are sufficiently definite that any reasonable official in the defendant's shoes would have understood that he was violating it. And that's a significant part. They noted, look, Casella had mere seconds to assess this potential threat. Now, Hughes's behavior was erratic enough to cause a 911 call. Now, Casella's confronted with a woman who's just been seen hacking a tree with a large kitchen knife and whose behavior was erratic enough to call a concerned to cause a concerned bystander to call 911 and then have the same person flag them down when they appear on the scene. Casella is separated from Hughes and Chadwick by a chain link fence. And so there's a barrier between all three officers and both Hughes and Chadwick. And Hughes had moved within a few feet of Chadwick and failed to acknowledge two commands to drop the knife. This is, so she's closed in very close proximity with this knife. She's not a threat at that point to the officers on being separated by a locked chain link fence, but she is a threat, a potential threat to the other person there, to Chadwick, the other woman, which is a very significant part. And she's only a few feet from her, and they can't get to her. And she failed to acknowledge the commands to drop the knife. Now, that's interesting. The court noted in the facts that it wasn't clear that she even was listening. In fact, the court said it wasn't clear that she even knew that they were there. The commands were loud enough that Chadwick heard them. Chadwick testified that she heard the commands to drop the knife, but she failed to acknowledge the commands. And in fact, she failed to acknowledge the officers were even present. It was like they weren't even there, the way that she was acting, which obviously adds to the whole equation. And so what the court said was, confronted with these facts, it is far from clear it's far from an obvious case. You know, when you have a case where you have a situation and it's just so obvious on its face that it's an excessive use of force case, then you don't have to have a case that's on all fours, as we say. You don't have to have another case exactly like it. in order to have a situation to where the court can say, no, we're not going to give you qualified immunity, because it can just be so obvious. But remember that quote, remember the quote that I had up earlier about how qualified immunity is going to protect all except for the just plainly incompetent. And this is far from that type of case. This is far from an obvious case. And so the Supreme Court reversed the Ninth Circuit and said that they even noted in one particular passage that the Ninth Circuit relied on a few cases for the proposition that there was a clearly established, this was clearly established law, that it was a violation of the Fourth Amendment. One of the cases they relied on was the Ruby Ridge FBI case, the Harris case. And the court said that the panel's reliance on Harris, quote, does not pass the straight face test. And so they said, for these reasons, the petition for cert was granted, and the judgment of the Court of Appeals was reversed, and the case was remanded for proceedings consistent with the opinion. There you go. The court noted, this has happened on more than one occasion. We've seen this, and here's a quote from a previous Supreme Court decision, which was quoting another one. The court said, this court has repeatedly told courts, and the Ninth Circuit in particular, not to define clearly established law at a high level of generality. And they're calling them out, and they keep calling them out in all these decisions. In this decision, in the San Francisco v. Sheehan decision, in Ashcroft versus Al-Kid decision, they're calling the Ninth Circuit out saying, you're not doing what we're telling you to do. And they did it again in this case. And so they call them out by name. It's the Ninth Circuit. They deny qualified immunity quite a bit and seem to have difficulty of applying what the Supreme Court has said that the rule is regarding qualified immunity. There was a dissent in this case, and it's a very scary dissent. And I want to spend just a few minutes talking about why I say that, why I say it's a scary. Now, obviously, that's an opinion, my personal opinion, but it does. It is a little scary, and I'm going to tell you why. I'm going to tell you exactly specific points that I have in the dissenting opinion. It was written by Justice Sotomayor, joined by Justice Ginsburg, and so we have Justices Sotomayor and Ginsburg, who wrote a dissenting opinion to a per curiam decision, which is it's not altogether unheard of, but it's a little uncommon. So these are all quotes from the dissenting opinion that I wanted to point out to you. The court, in the dissent, Justice Sotomayor said, made point of the fact that Hughes held the kitchen knife at her side with the blade facing away from Chadwick. And she also noted that Chadwick was never in fear of Hughes. Now, this isn't really relevant. And there doesn't have to be fear. Remember, the test is an objective test. It's not subjective on anyone's part, whether the potential victim, or which was Chadwick in this case, or the officers. That fear is a subjective thing, and it's not a requirement under Graham versus Connor. The fact that Chadwick was never in fear of Hughes is not relevant, and to the extent that they actually feel that is relevant and important in dissenting to this decision, it's kind of scary. It's a little scary that they're even looking at that, and the fact that they said she held the kitchen knife at her side with the blade facing away from Chadwick. So totally disregarding the fact that she's only a few feet away. How long does it take to stab somebody with a kitchen knife? And if you've got a person who's erratic, it can happen in just a flash of a split second. Hughes committed no crime, but the officers hastily drew their guns. And it seems to suggest that the officers were all three of them were in the wrong for even drawing their weapons, because she had committed no crime. But it wasn't a 911 call about a crime that was committed. It was about a person that was erratic and acting strangely, who had a large knife, hacking at a tree with a large knife. And so that's that's a little disconcerting, the fact that they considered that to be significant in their calculus of the decision. And then they said Hughes may not have heard or understood the officer's command to drop the knife and may not been aware of their presence at all. You would think that that would work in favor of the officers. The fact that she's not responding, not even, she's so zoned out, she's not even aware of their presence. Even though Chadwick says she clearly heard the officer say more than once, drop the knife, and she's standing 6 feet away, less than 6 feet away from Hughes at this point, the fact that Hughes seemed to be in a daze and wasn't aware of their presence, they take that to work in favor of the force being excessive. But I think that equally works in the opposite direction. And another one, although the officers were in uniform, they never verbally identified themselves as law enforcement officers. And I don't even get that, to be honest with you. You have three officers in uniform with their weapons drawn just a matter of feet away from you. The fact that they never verbally identified themselves as LEOs was significant in the dissent for whatever reason. They also said that Casella immediately and unilaterally escalated the situation. I don't know how, other than the fact he fired, I guess that escalates the situation. But her coming out of the house with a knife in her hand, rapidly closing on Chadwick, and then failing to drop the blade, I don't know how, whether it's because he dropped to the ground, I don't know. It leads on to what they said next, that the two officers on the scene did not use deadly force. And yet that two officers on the scene did not use deadly force reveals just how necessary and unreasonable it was for Casella to fire four shots. Now, what this is, and what this is saying, basically, is that reasonableness is a line and not a range. Reasonableness is a point. And so that you can't have a situation where different officers would do different things. And that's a scary proposition, too. In the 10 years I spent at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center training officers, we talk about a range of reasonableness, that there's no one correct decision, that what one officer does and another officer does might be different, but they might both be reasonable in that range of reasonableness. They don't have to do the exact same thing. Well, here, the dissent seems to be penalizing the officer Casella based on the fact that the other two officers didn't do the exact same thing. So in other words, since all three of them did not fire at her, at Hughes, that just shows how unnecessary and unreasonable it was. And that makes use of force a point. It makes it there's only one single thing that's reasonable and not a range of reasonableness. So the question should be, was deadly force reasonable, period? You don't have to use a lesser alternative. And the court noted that the dissent noted that Casella fired without attempting a less dangerous type of method like firing a taser. And that's not the question either. And there's no spectrum. But the question is, plain and simple, was the use of deadly force reasonable? Now, fortunately, Hughes didn't die as a result of this. The four shots were non-life threatening, and it kind of makes you wonder exactly where would the officer was aiming. But that doesn't change the fact that it was. It's deadly force, obviously, whenever they fire their weapon at someone, it's going to be the use of deadly force. And it creates a situation to where you've got a person who seems to have a problem, a mental issue, with a knife that's only a few feet away from someone. How fast would it take? How long? Remember, this all happened inside of 60 seconds. How long do the justices think it would take for someone who's 6 feet away with a kitchen knife to stab someone? They've clearly never seen the number of videos that I've seen with law enforcement officers actually shooting someone with a knife on drugs, who was able to stab someone even after they were repeatedly hit with a firearm, close the gap. very scary type of situation. So to wrap it all up, this is because Casella plainly lacked any legitimate interest. Listen to this. Because Casella plainly lacked any legitimate interest justifying the use of deadly force against a woman who posed no objective threat of harm to officers or others, had committed no crime, and appeared calm and collected during the police encounter, he was not entitled to qualified immunity. No mention of the fact that she's only 6 feet away. She could have stabbed the woman at any point. And the fact that she was acting erratically and not even responding, not even acknowledging the presence of the police officers there. That's a pretty scary sentence in my opinion. And I'm very glad that that was a dissenting opinion, but an opinion. You've got two of the nine justices putting that and pinning that from a law enforcement perspective. It's a kind of a scary concept. Okay. And you know, the last little tidbit, a little bit of editorial, the criminal justice system isn't meant to resolve mental health problems in this country. And yet that's repeatedly what we're asking LEOs to do. And it's just, it's a bad situation. We're going to see a lot more of these cases. Because we rely on the criminal justice process to handle them, all the mental health issues, we're going to see a lot more of these cases and a lot more of situations that where we have mentally unstable people with weapons. We're going to see this a lot. And unfortunately, if history repeats itself, we're going to see a lot of these decisions go into the Supreme Court from the Ninth Circuit. They're going to continue to lead the way because they apparently have a significant issue with actually complying with what the Supreme Court's been repeatedly telling them over the last several years regarding qualified immunity. We'll see more. I'm sure we'll see more of these cases in the not too distant future. So thanks for joining me here on the Broadcast Blue on the Brown Bag Wednesday podcast. You can check out our website at www.broadcastblue for information regarding upcoming webinars, podcasts, and also how to stream them if you want to actually watch the videos after they've been recorded. Thank you so much for joining me here today, and we'll be back in a couple of weeks with another podcast here on Broadcast Blue.